ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
ABC AFL Daily for your Tuesday as we look back on all the agenda-setting shows in the footy landscape from a Monday night. My name's Corbin Middlemouse. Alongside me, former All-Australian captain, Western Bulldogs favourite son of the West,
Heartthrob.
Bob Murphy.
Heartthrob.
All of that. ABC Melbourne breakfast host. The list goes on.
So long, but let's cut it there. Corbin, it's good to be in your company. How are you, mate?
I'm very well. You were watching the Blues, obviously, on Sunday on ABC Sport.
What a day. What an afternoon that was.
Yeah. Got a little quick hit news here. I always like to just cover off on things that we haven't necessarily covered in our audio samples from the shows. Changes to the lasso rule. So we brought in the new rule, last disposal out of bounds. We've seen a lot of players basically make the sort of sliding, lunging effort just to get any kind of touch on the ball before it goes over the boundary line. Basically, the AFL have come out and said, hey, from now on, if you're going to do that and just push the ball straight out of play, that's insufficient intent. So that's also going to be a free kick. If you're going to dive, you know, Wayne Harms-esque, we're expecting you to make the Wayne Harms play and whack the ball back into the field of play. So that's what they're now asking you to do if you put the headfirst dive in towards the boundary line.
I mean, there's, you know, when you build something and a new rule is essentially you're putting an extension on the back of the house. Is this more like the no more gaps stuff, or is it a bit of chewing gum to go, oh, well, that bit's a bit wobbly, so just shove that in the corner and then stick it together. I mean, I don't mind it. I do find it amusing that we got three or four games in and we're already like, they're on to us. The players have already... They're cunning, aren't they, the players?
They are.
I wouldn't say all of us, include myself, we're not the sharpest bunch, but we can be cunning.
there's always ways around everything, isn't there, in the way that the game's umpired and the rules. And I think by and large, it's been for the better, hasn't it? Small sample size, we're only 3 weeks in, but I think we like the changes.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, we'll talk about the footy from the weekend, but just watching it live, there's more unpredictability in the games. And that's what I like to see. It's not necessarily the high scoring or just open ball movement, but I love seeing one-on-one contests and unpredictability. And I'm seeing more of that, so I'm pretty happy at the moment.
Our Carlton friends are having a rough week over and wore navy blue today.
I wore black.
Yes.
You know, so Johnny Cash style might be going to a funeral.
Probably more appropriate. Caroline Wilson on the agenda setters last night.
There was panic after halftime yesterday, on and off the field, on the bench, and it does come down to coaching. What is even more worrying and more ominous for me now, Craig, is that last week the Blues executive went on a media offensive. President Rob Priestley, CEO Wright, spoke to the chief footy writers of the two newspapers. They did the media rounds yesterday. I can't see it going much further for Michael Voss. His contract has only been guaranteed into the 2026 season. The last time those sort of media briefings went on, and I attended one of them, was the former president, Mark Lejudice, and his then CEO, Stephen Trigg. There was no Mick Malthouse. There was no Michael Voss at any of these media briefings. And Mick Malthouse was gone in 5 or 6 weeks those media briefings.
Are you saying you think he'll struggle to last the season?
The club are painting a future for the public without Michael Voss.
How bad was Sunday for Michael Voss?
Oh, it was devastatingly bad. It was all of the ingredients. The question marks and the criticisms of Carlton were all on display. The good, which we saw early, and then all of the bad. So it was a minestrone of bad for Michael Voss and Carlton on the weekend.
How many are of his own making? So you know what it's like, whenever things are bad, it's like, let's apportion blame and work out sort of how we distribute it. How much is on the senior coach? And, you know, we all know the buck event, you know, ultimately stops with him, but how much of this mess is at his feet?
We can't talk in absolutes from our vantage point from afar, but I think we can make a reasonable assumption that with the changes that they brought in around Michael Voss, kept Michael Voss, changed the team around him, and have had some, you know, player personnel change, all of those things taken into account. My question is still about where do they go when they find themselves under pressure? So a simple way to think about it, for me anyway, I don't know if it's for other people, when a side kicks two goals in a row, where do the players go mentally? What do they? How do they react? Now, what you would hope that they do is they would go back to what their role is and they understand that role just inside out, and that that role is designed to help the teammates around them. That's a big part of Michael Voss's job. Is it his entire job? No, but it's a big part of it.
Mm.
And the strength of having a coach, or the opportunity of having a coach on the sideline, is that he can help reset them better than a coach in the coach's box. So this is the thing that continually looks to trip them up, and other sides now see it as an absolute opportunity. They're so vulnerable. And we spoke to Bailey Fritch in the rooms after the victory. You could tell they knew that if they just hung in there that Carlton would get wobbly. That's paraphrasing Bailey Fritch, but that's essentially where we led the question and where his answer went, that they're vulnerable. And they just can't handle the pressure. When the game's played on their terms and they play with instinct, they're really talented. They got enough talent to play.
Yeah.
But when the pressure comes on, like an actor that doesn't quite know their lines, so they're not able to listen to the other actors or react off the other teammates, you know. So that there's a lot of responsibility that sits with Michael Voss to understand that stuff.
It's and we've had this conversation around the Blues now going back what a couple of years, where you go, you know, was it physical originally? Is it mental? Is it strategic, or whatever the reasons for it? I mean, the numbers are so stark in terms of, you know, second half numbers compared to first half numbers, and we could rattle off a whole lot of those, but we all know what it is at this stage.
The mental and the physical, it's entwined like rope.
Yep.
You know, so again, this is just my assessment of it, but with the ball movement, Carlton play two styles, fast and slow. That's what most clubs are doing. A variation of that. They might say there's another, a moderate or whatever, but they essentially have a fast ballistic ball movement and then a slow methodical ball movement. When the Blues go into slow methodical ball movement, for some reason, then their team defence goes into slow methodical on their heels. That is not what anyone wants. That's why they look like they're reactive and on their heels, because, we're going slow now. Not for team defence.
Yep.
That doesn't have any tempo shift. It's always fast and fierce and ballistic. And now they've gone safe and they're on their heels.
So I guess the obvious question the Carlton fans will want to know, is it correctable? Is that something that you can do in season, you know, game 3 to 4 in a season? Is that something that they can change?
Well, it depends if they're having the same conversation we're having. If it's having a similar conversation to ours, I would say that there is hope that you can shift that with some smart people in the room. But I don't know. They may be having a completely different conversation that may be more complex or even more simple than my little one-stop shop that I've offered you up today.
You can imagine every single show covered it off, as we did last night on AFL Monday, which you can catch up on here through ABC AFL Daily. On Footy Classified over on the Nine Network, Matthew Lloyd had this to say about Michael Voss.
I've never done this before because I don't like doing this, because coaches know where they want to be. But I just think the reason you sit on the bench is because of your relationship with players and the communication with players. I don't see Michael communicate that much with players that it's that beneficial that he needs to be down there. But what he is lacking is the strategy side of it. So my belief is that if I was Graham Wright, I'd say, Michael, it's time for you to go upstairs, or at a minimum you need to go juggle it where you need to. But he needs to be up in that box with his assistants, with his right-hand man, and discussing scenarios. I don't think you can do that well down there. You can't see the ground that well down there.
It can become a yearly conversation for the embattled coach, the bench or the box.
Look, I think it's a bit of a free hit at the moment at Carlton. You can throw anything you like at Carlton, and they probably won't throw anything back. They're covering up, and I think that's a pretty easy one to throw, that he should be up in the coach's box. The only thing I would say is there would be a lot of thought goes into the why. I would love to know the why. I would love to know how it works, who's directly in Vossie's ear, what that relationship is like. They will never tell us in the detail we would want, but I would be fascinated as to the why, what benefit Michael Voss gets from there than he gets up in the box. I don't have enough access to see Michael Voss on the bench. I know it feels like he's constantly in the frame,
yeah,
but But in reality, he's not.
Did your coaches ever sit on the bench much?
In my time, they were always up in the box and then occasionally would be down. But that was rare. That was rare. That was a long time ago, the call. But thanks for bringing it up.
No, that's all right. What about a Fremantle?
Down memory lane.
JL would have been... JL, he had a brief period on the bench.
JL went down to the bench when it was, you know, not quite crisis time, but there was a real... Yep. He really wanted to get his hands on it. And I think Justin would admit himself, that's not his strong suit, you know, in terms of his ability. He loves the human Tetris and battleships of footy. That's where his real strength is. So he didn't last long down there because he was of more use up in the coach's box. I don't know Michael Voss well enough to know. He obviously staunchly believes that that's where he's best suited. I've never really heard it explained why. He may have spoken about that. I just haven't heard him talk about it.
Very short term for Carlton's, obviously, this Friday night up against North Melbourne in what is the Kangaroos' biggest game. It's a fascinating fixture, their biggest game of the home and away season on Good Friday. The long term's, obviously, how do we, you know, like Michelangelo, every slab of stone, you can get a sculpture out of all that. Obviously, trying to form a premiership team. But in the medium term, which is 12 months, is Michael Voss is trying to win a new contract. He's off contract at season's end. How does he do that? Like, what does he need to do to prove that he's the man to coach this team in 2027?
Well, I mean, in simple terms, they need to win games. For me, it's they'll win and lose. I mean, you can give me the numbers. They won't play finals. They don't deserve to be anywhere near finals. They'll have a win-loss of some type. It's how they lose. And it's the manner in which they respond to these momentum shifts. If they can arrest that and then start to win some games, then maybe. But at the moment, we just see these wild fluctuations that lend themselves to thinking underneath the ice, the tip of the iceberg, there's not much there.
Yeah. It's hard to think if they don't make the 10, though, he's going to be there, which is harsh. I mean, that given the fact they've taken a step backwards to go forward, even by their own estimations.
I mean, and yet, you sound even more hopeful than me. I think it's pretty dire.
Yeah. And so I just... if he was your guy and you were making that move as a club with your list and everything else, you would think you would extend out the coach and say, hey, he's our guy. Mm. And yet they're making decisions on him, whether they want to commit to him for the long term, while they don't have a top 10 list. They don't have a top 8 list.
Well, particularly when they lived through all of this anxiety and speculation last year, to be at this point so early in the year with the ferocity of the outside noise so loud, it's bleeding obvious, but it's a disaster so far.
Let's jump over to Fox Footy on the couch last night. Obviously, the hot button issue out of Saturday night was the Tristan Sherry episode, and the verdict came down. So a 3-match ban for the North Melbourne Ruckman. It was debated on the couch last night between Jack Riewoldt and Nathan Buckley.
My opinion is it's light. I thought 5 was probably where we would need to start with this. It's hard to draw comparisons to other accidents or other incidents. I would have this up there with spitting.
Well, yeah. I wiped it on. So Lingy, it was the first year the rule was in place, and you had to go off whether blood was on your shorts, your Guernsey, anywhere. And Lingy had cut me.
Yeah. So Lingy, you got a week for?
Lingy cut me, and he got a week for, and he's in my face clapping. And I thought, well, if I'm going to go off, you're going to go off. So it was a very logical decision by me to get him off with me. Dipper at the time was in the media, and he said I should get 8 weeks. So I understand there's a. It's got the ick, hasn't it? Like any kicking, spitting, anything to do with blood, it has an absolute ick factor in terms of it's unacceptable.
Fabric of the game.
Tristan, well, what is the fabric of the game, mate? It's not great sportsmanship.
That was Nathan Buckley and Jack Riewoldt last night.
That had a bit of everything. I loved that. That was top shelf from Bucks. We had a logical decision, which I absolutely loved. Then he had 2 icks.
Yep.
And then Jack Riewoldt's gone with the fabric of the game. Only missed opportunity there, Bucks going, well, I put blood on the fabric of the game, man. That's why I got myself a week. Then Dipper got a mention. Oh, what an absolute football antipasto plate that was. Having said all of that, I tend to agree with Jack Riewoldt. I was thinking it would be more in the line of 5 weeks. again, with something so unusual, people there will be more of a wild variance of, you know, people calling for 8 weeks. Oh, it's probably worth a week. You know, so I understand there'll be a fair bit of variance in that. But I found myself thinking, I thought the game would take a dimmer view of it and give it 5 weeks. I do wonder what difference would have happened. And now we are in hypothetical territory here. What if Tristan Cherry had blood on his hand and there ended up being blood on Andy McGrath's cheek? I think that would have changed the entire...
What you're saying, if it was more visible?
Like if it was more visible.
Yeah.
Cherry red, if you like.
Yeah. Yeah.
Tristan Cherry.
I kind of feel like...
Cherry red, Tristan
yes,
Cherry.
I like that. I like it. Whether it's three
must,
weeks...
Must have been awesome if I had to say that.
No,
times.
No, no. Sorry, I need to pick up what you're putting down. If it's 5 weeks or it's 3 weeks, are we not sending the same message? It's not as if this is an issue that happens every single weekend, for example. Like, it's not something we're trying to stamp out of the game or...
I understand what you mean. My own personal rationale for that is you can get 3 weeks for a dangerous tackle.
Yeah.
And this just felt like, well, this is so unusual and so unsavory that I just thought, I thought it might be separated from those suspensions that are more part of the game, if that makes sense. And a 5 week would have been like, oh,
yeah,
jumps off the page a bit more than, oh yeah, and so-and-so's out for two and he got a week and Cherry's out for three.
Yeah. Yep, I can understand that. It's
an illogical response I've given you there.
Like, we basically haven't seen it. I think there was an incident with Jeremy Howe where he wiped blood on the shorts of an opponent, but we basically haven't seen something like this properly in 20 years, and hopefully it's another 20 years
until
we
difference.
See it again.
Some people say, oh, semantics, like, you know, you brush your head on someone's jumper. Mm. I feel like there's a chasm between that and wiping blood from my own face and then smearing it on your cheek.
So close to someone's mouth.
Yeah, it's just, it's not the same ballpark.
Out of the same game, Zach Merritt was well held. So he was kept at 10 disposals by second-year Roo Finn O'Sullivan, who's a tremendous young player, picked two in the draft a couple of years ago. Kane Corns was dissecting Zach Merritt's game on the Agenda Setters on Channel 7 last night.
I've been on Merritt watch since round one against Hawthorn because I think he's changed his game. He wants to be an outside receiver. O'Sullivan goes to him and he did not want to defend. Now, I never thought I would say this about Zach Merritt, but I thought he gave up. Now, I've played on players...
Gave up. It's a heavy description.
I've played on players that have given up probably 100 times in my career, Hutchie. You can see it straight away. When I say give up, he doesn't want contact. He's playing against a 25-gamer O'Sullivan who was outstanding. He was hungry, but there was missed tackles. There was dual missed tackles. There's a lack of physicality. There's a want to be on the outside receiving and not a want to be inside leading. So for 2-3 weeks in a row, I look at Zach Merritt and go, where's the leadership? He bumped off the ball there by a 25-gamer. Yeah. And I never thought I would see the day where that proud player, a six-timer, gave up.
He's a fascinating conversation piece and one that I'm sure will keep repeating on us all year long. So 10 disposals. There were also reports, I think Triple M mentioned on the weekend, that Merritt sat by himself for a long period of time in the rooms post-game, full playing strip. So while the rest of his teammates, you know, got dressed and showered and made their way out, and he was just sitting there solo having a moment to himself. Penny, for your thoughts type moment, I'm sure, for Zach Merritt as to what he made of Saturday night.
Yeah, look, a couple of things I would add to that. I mean, that's a fascinating take, as is the modern vernacular, from Kane Corns there. I think even the best players are entitled to have a quiet day and a bad day. And, you know, that is probably, you know, well, that is more likely when you get tagged. I watched the game. He was noticeably well held, Zach Merritt, and not as physical as what he usually is. The thing I would say about Kane in this regard, that footy expert gets thrown around pretty loosely. Kane is an expert, an absolute expert as a tagger. Mm. So when he talks about players' behaviour of getting close checking and how they handle that and what they've been as a player and then how they react and their actions after that, he is on as solid a ground as any player in the game's ever produced. So I think that, you know, Kane talks a lot about a lot of players. That is something that we should really listen to. And I, for one, will be watching more closely in the coming weeks of Zach Merritt, just on the back of Kane's insight there.
Yeah, I got the feeling he's going to get more and more attention, though, isn't he? If, you know, someone sits on him and holds him to 10. I mean, the unavoidable backdrop is obviously everything that happened over the summer and the fact that he's still wearing the jumper. And so every action and everything that he does is going to be scrutinised very much through that lens.
Yeah. If there's one bit of advice I could give to young footballers out there, the first time you get tagged, don't be quiet.
Yep.
Because then you get the reputation and then you just get tagged. Now, Zach Merritt is not a young player and he doesn't need that advice. He'll navigate his way through it, but... just you've got to fight and scrap and just be so desperate to overcome that tag if you don't want it to happen every week.
Oh, it's fascinating what they're going to do with him going forward. What Essendon does with him, what he does playing for the Bombers for the remainder of the year, how opposition teams approach him, what happens at season's end.
Do you think it will have another life at season's end when this is just an annual...
Yeah. I thought no for the... Over the first part of the season, I thought, they'll work it out and he'll be a Bomber for life and looks like there's going to be an extension of the contract and everything else. But it hasn't panned out the way I thought it was going to be. We're not even out of March.
Don't think there'll be three first-rounders.
We're not even out of March. Which brings us to this, by the way. It's a perfect segue. Nice. That's what we're all about,
you
segues game.
Slick.
Same program, the Agenda Setters on 7 last night, talking about the West Coast Eagles and their little glow-up that they've had with two wins through the first 3 weeks. Nick Riewoldt.
And you wonder what psychologically it does for someone like Harley Reid to have a running mate like Willem Dersma as well. And so we lamented the decision of Essendon to hang on and retain Zach Merritt. Well, you look at what trading out a player like Oscar Allen, who wanted out, does. You bear fruit and you're able to fast-track a rebuild with Dersma, with the young talent that have been able to...
The kids around were
happy about the Allen trade and everyone's miserable.
Here you go
from the
weekend.
The lack of trade with Merritt.
So the comparison was made there between, you know, Oscar Allen goes, the West Coast Eagles are better for it, they are able to get some high picks in, Zach Merritt stays, seemingly everybody's unhappy at the Bombers for what happened. Are they analogous to one another as such, the two episodes between both clubs' captains?
Look, all of us in the media can overreach at times, but it is a pretty good analogy of... these are the two ways you can handle that situation of a captain leading. Can you go, you know what, if you want out, okay, we'll take what we can get. Or no, as an entire club, we are protecting the battle lines. Now, over time, we'll find out what worked best for your club. But it's a fair and reasonable assessment. It's not quite apples and apples, but it's not completely off the mark either, though. Now,
so there's two parts. There's one that's the value of what you're actually getting. So I think that's the other thing to point out, that it felt like the Eagles got overs for Oscar Allen. I think if you were to put him up on the trade table, no one was going to offer you pick two for him.
Mm-hmm.
And yet that's what they got on the compensation. Whereas for Zach Merritt, the three first rounders that are always quoted was pick 10, pick 22, and a future first, which is Hawthorne's first this year, which at the moment is looking like, you know, a pick in the high teens. And so you sort of think, well, Zach's probably worth a bit more than that and Oscar Allen's probably worth a bit less than that. So the Eagles were probably happy to pack him up and send him off.
So that's
the Bombers were probably thinking, we're getting ripped off.
Okay, but we're just talking about the tangibles there. What about the intangibles?
That's the other. And this is where, I mean, you're the man to speak to on what it does for a locker room and everything else. And at the time, I was adamant that the Bombers made the right decision holding him to the deal. And I mean, small sample size, but 4 weeks in, it looks like they would have been better off cutting their losses.
Yeah, my instinct, I think we may have said it every week on this pod. We may say it every week for the rest of the pod. And I'm okay with that, Corbin. But at the time, I thought if your captain wants out, just cut him loose. But I was intrigued about Essendon saying, you know what? This is a whole club, and it felt like it very much was an Andrew Welsh board decision of like, no, 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 we are not going to do that. We are a different club. And I found that intriguing. Mm-hmm. Now, right at the moment, you'd think, horrendous call. But we'll see.
The Eagles with back-to-back Rising Star noms too. So Willem Dersma, the number one pick, is this week's Rising Star.
Gippsland boy.
Last time they
for Gippsland.
Last time they had back-to-back Rising Star noms was 2004. Bo Waters and Sam Butler, who, went on to become premiership players.
Yeah, of course. I thought you were going to quiz me then on who they were. I wouldn't have got that.
Yeah.
I wouldn't have got that.
Mark Seabee was one in and around the same time. So they had three in about a 4 or 5 week period. There's a lot of love for the Eagles at the moment.
Well, that's what you would want to hear as an Eagles fan, wouldn't you? They've gone through the lowest of the lows in recent years. I mean, they're probably as bad an AFL team as we've seen for a long, long time. last couple of years. So to see them sort of re-emerge early this year, it's kind of a nice feeling, if we can say that. Yeah. So they're building something and happy for Andrew McWalter.
Feels a bit stiff getting to AFL 360 last on Fox 40 last night. They had a good night with Alistair Clarkson, who's now about to go past Norm Smith in the games record for most games coached. So he'll be outright ninth by the time we get to Friday night. And also joining him was Chris Fagan, of course, the two-time reigning defending premiership coach of the Brisbane Lions. He was asked about Nick Daicos, of course, ahead of the Thursday night showdown.
Yeah, there'll be a conversation about that. I mean, Daicos is a super player. We'll be giving him some sort of attention, and I'm not quite sure whether it'll be a Josh Dunkley or a Jared Verry, or whether it's, you know, a full-on tag, or whether it's just around stoppage. It's just something we need to talk about during the week, but you've got to respect his ability and what he means to their team.
At least they're talking about it. Mm-hmm. And Nick Daicos has had 41, 33 and 2, 36 and 2. He's polled 8 of a possible 9 votes in the ABC Footballer of the Year through the Pies' first 3 games of the season. Is he unstoppable, or why is no one going to him?
Well, he's pretty hard to stop. You know, just because you decide to tag him doesn't necessarily mean that you can thwart his influence. But I would think he's at a level, and there's only, you know, there's probably only half a dozen of those midfielders that they're at a level that you think, you know what, part of our team defence and part of our system, in inverted commas, is to have someone as close with him as possible. I'm fascinated to see if there's someone that can go all the way with him. I don't think there is. If Chris Fagan, unless he's giving us a red herring there, Berry and Dunkley don't have that running power to go with him all over the ground. But there might be a combination of, you know, could they take him around stoppage? And then is there a defender who has the nous and the attributes to go with him when he's forward? I mean, Dane Zorko, that's not generally his go, but he's got the kind of raw athleticism to do it. I wonder if that's something that they would consider when he's forward, have someone like Zorko go to him and then Dunkley or Berry look after him around the middle of the ground.
Can I throw an obscure one too?
So please.
This man got a few sort of centre bounce attendances, as we call them, midfield minutes in the game against the Swans, given they were a little depleted. What about Darcy Wilmot? Like, what about if they say to someone like that, hey, this is something different for you. It's something Nick wouldn't have seen before or the rest of the competition. Would that work, at least in, as you said, at parts, even if it's not around stoppage or if you, you know, leave that to Dunkley or whatever, and the rest of the time he runs around and keeps him company?
You know what? One of the things that used to happen in my time, I don't know if it still happens, but often, well, young players, but even older players, but generally it would be a younger player so desperate to get a game, go and knock on the coach's door and say, I want Daicos, or I want Buckley, or I want Middlemass. Yep. You know, those sort of, it was the obvious third one.
Yes.
Those sort of things used to happen. I'd like to think they still might happen.
Yeah.
But that's the sort of thing, you know, if someone's in Darcy's world of like, hey, he's like, you know, I'd like to have a crack at it. What do you got to lose?
Correct. If you're not playing anyway, or you haven't got a huge role on the team.
He gets 40 anyway.
Yeah.
You know.
Correct.
If you keep him to 2 Brownlow votes, you probably get your teammate of the week.
Felt like Brisbane worked it out last year, so maybe we trust Chris Fagan and the Lions to know what they're doing here. So round 6 last year, Daicos had 38-1, the Pies won. They played again in round 21, he had 29-1, so he'd come off
quiet
a little bit. They lost.
Yeah, quiet.
Then they met again in the prelim, he didn't hit the scoreboard and had 27.
Gone cold, Daicos. Look, that's trajectory. That's just numbers.
Down and to the right.
It's the graph.
So we'll see what we get on Thursday night. Also on AFL 360 last night, this has got a strong reaction on social media too. The conversation between Jared Waitley and Gary Lyon about the start time to the 2026 and 27 grand finals, of course, has been locked in for 2:30 in the afternoon.
Who are the key stakeholders? Who would be the key stakeholders?
So, yes.
It's certainly not the broadcasters.
No, so it's fans over television. But still, is the misnomer in that is television actually brings the game to the fans, and you do get more fans in television in prime time than you do in the middle of the afternoon, and that's just a convention of the way it works. Where it ratchets up the stakes is here, where the NRL Grand Final outrated the AFL Grand Final, which is a rarity last year. Now, the AFL, I think, would take the view, well, there was a Brisbane team and a Melbourne team and the Strongholders in Sydney. So we'll see. There have been all sorts of combinations that have played both Grand Finals and hasn't delivered that result previously. the AFL, had it slid to twilight, would have beaten the NRL Grand Final, which sort of has reaches a certain point. Staying in the afternoon makes it a contest. And if it loses for the next 2 years to the NRL Grand Final, it will have been a mistake.
Do you think it worries the AFL?
It should.
That was Jared and Gary last night on AFL 360. Mm. So the perfectly logical conversation, talking about, you know, the ratings battle and everything else. You can imagine the social media conversation is, oh, the only people talking about it are you media stooges and everything else, and the fans want it at 2:30. We're sick of having this conversation shoved down our throat and everything else. But, I mean, that's – and here we are as media people probably about to talk about it again and everything else. And that's the battle that the AFL are in, and clearly they've decided to side with the fans, you know, by and large, who have voted in every opinion poll just about out there.
So do you believe that they've sided with the fans? Do you think that was the main priority there?
The only other reason they could possibly be doing it is trying to hold it over to the next broadcast year. But then you think, if you do that as a bargaining tool, yeah, by the time they get to the next broadcast agreement, which is, what, another 5 years away, if you've had 3 or 4 years, as Jared says there, of getting, you know, edged out by the NRL as the number one program of the year, doesn't that actually lower your price anyway? So rather than saying, hey, pay us more money because we're going to move the grand final to the night time, the broadcasters could basically go back and say, hey, when we bought it last time, you were the number one program in television. You're not even that anymore.
Mm. Unless they can show them that they think the time slot change would take it to a whole new level.
Mm.
That side of it, I listen and feel like the student, because the broadcasting detail that Jared and Gary talk about there, they know that a lot more in depth than what I do. I'm still stunned that the grand final is not a twilight. I just think once it happens once, and the spectators see and crowds see and everyone experiences it, go, oh, that's quite good. It's actually really good. Now, the pre-game entertainment, not that we need it, but it looks better. And the game looked more spectacular. I just think it'll be one of those things once it actually happens, moving aside from the dollars and the broadcasting rights, which are probably the major factors in it. I just think as a spectacle, once we get there, I'm in the camp of, I think we'll never look back.
We're talking about two hours too, aren't we? I don't think anyone's campaigning for like a 750 bounce or anything. I don't know if there's one. Maybe there are some TV executives or whatever somewhere in some back rooms that we don't see or whatever that are saying that. But I think most people in footy, whether you work in the media or you just
you know those incredible preliminary finals that are twilight. Those ones.
Yep.
That's what it'll be.
They work pretty good, don't they?
You know how good they look.
Why do you think they've done it? Why have they locked it away for 2 years in the daytime?
I assumed it was part of a TV broadcast bargaining chip. That was where my thoughts went. And look, it's not what gets me out of bed in the morning, that topic. But that was where I sort of thought, that's probably it. And then I didn't give it a whole lot of thought after that, Corbin. You know, as too busy thinking about the Blues and what role they needed to play.
Understandable.
That kind of thing.
It's a pretty big game this week. Your mighty Bulldogs up against the Bombers Sunday night, which was meant to...
Awkward one for you and I.
It was meant to be that. Give me a line. Give me a number. what's the handicap?
This is the thing about sport. If we knew what was going to happen, Corbin, if we knew what was going to happen, we wouldn't even show up.
I think I know what's going to happen this week. I would love nothing more than the whole, you know, leaning to Lake Placid and maybe it'll be a miracle and all the rest of it.
Didn't love preparing for these games. If I was a Bulldog player, didn't. Yep. It's
everyone thinks you're going to win.
And it's people around you. You could say, should be an easy win this week, like in your life, you just become a borderline paranoid with your own teammates of like, is that something? Are they complacent?
Yeah.
And once you start thinking, is someone being complacent? You know what your brain hears?
Yeah.
Complacent.
Yeah.
Complacent. And you start to worry. And so your mind's off it. Mm. So it could be a distraction the other way too when you go in red hot favourite.
Do you know the best I can hope for out of the game? I hope that you and I are not talking about the game next Tuesday. I hope there's nothing that comes from it that leads us to sit here and have a conversation next Tuesday.
You've got to set yourself up to win in life, you know.
Appreciate your insights as always, Bob.
Great to chat, Corbin.
Keep it locked. 5 episodes each week, your footy conversation right here on ABC AFL Daily.